This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Listen to more of Charlottesville's own public media at cvillepodcast.com. On February 20th, 2009, artist William Cochran addressed the society on the topic, The Power of Seeing Differently.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here this evening. I want to thank this society and Bailey for your wonderful hospitality. I have very much enjoyed reading your website. I'm particularly impressed with the sheer number of people and organizations the society has declared war on. I'm envious because I often wish to do the same. I would like to study exactly how you go about it and try to adopt your strategies. I wish to acknowledge the presence of a VIP in my life, which is David Grieber, who graduated from here and lived on this in this section. He has been like a brother to me for years, a sword and a shield. He is my attorney. For years, he served in that capacity pro bono, because as a public artist, you're not necessarily made of money, and we've seen many a battle and a struggle. And he has been just a tremendous asset. I also wish to honor and acknowledge my partner, Teresa Cochran, with whom I've worked now for 15 years. And she is my partner as an artist and in my life as my wife and the mother of my children. Yeah, tremendous honor to be associated with her. I am an artist, which is the strangest thing. When I was in college, if you had said, this is what you will do, I would have said, nah. Not possible. I didn't become an artist. I'm 53 now. I didn't become an artist until I was in my early 30s. And when I was in college, I was involved in theater, philosophy, literature. Never art. Never went into the art building, even once that I can recall. And I think it's because I just assumed that that wasn't for me, that I didn't have whatever it took, whatever artists had to be artists. And I've spent my career as an artist trying to destroy the myth of talent. I don't think talent is anything that's real. And we'll talk a little bit about that tonight. But I became an artist. I was explaining this over dinner because I was feeling like I was wasting my life. There was something I was supposed to be doing. And someone said to me, well, if you could do anything you wanted to do, and it didn't matter what it was, but you were guaranteed to be successful, what would you pick? And at that moment, I realized that what I wanted to do was create images so integrated into the walls of cities right out on the street that you would walk by and assume it was real and not, and therefore you'd start interacting with it before you realized it wasn't real. This is as clear as I can express what I saw. It's very clear in my mind. And I was actually disappointed to find out that was something called art. And people had thought of that before, you know, because it seemed so very original. So I immediately began moving in that direction. I don't consider that a very necessarily very interesting story, but I just want to give you some insight into how I began practicing art. Artists oftentimes are doing new things all the time in order to learn how to do it. Picasso said, I'm always doing that which I do not know how to do in order that I may learn how to do it. Artists are always doing that, and it's a very tricky way to make a living, but it's also a very tricky way to exist in the world, always to do what you don't know how to do. Maybe that's the nature of higher education anyway. But why don't we start with a few images? This, for example, is a glass work, and I don't often work in glass, but I do sometimes. And this is in St. Louis, and from outside it looks like a blank dark shape. You're not sure if it's a door or a window, and there's a pattern of text that's etched into the surface. And it's actually embedded permanently in the wall of an art center. And if you go into the center and look at it from the other side, the images transform. This is acid-etched, mouth-blown glass. And one of the curious things about being an artist is you're always working kind of in the dirt. Glass and pigment and artist materials are all really just forms of dirt. You're always playing with your hands and working in the dirt. And the goal is to try to make it come alive. And when I get finished a project like this, I don't think about it as good art or bad art or anything like that. I think about it as it was a survivable event, you know? It's such an intense process. You feel like you're going to die because you're on the line. You're supposed to create this landmark. You've chosen to work in a material you haven't worked in before because you have this vision you're trying to create. As Teresa can tell you, I call her up and I tell her, I'm not going to survive this time. You know, it's too difficult. The text was gathered from both sides of Del Mar Boulevard in St. Louis, which is one of the most segregated cities in the country, and the Arts Center decided to move here rather than into the wealthy area of town because they really wanted to make a difference. And so the text was simply answers people gave of all ages and backgrounds to a question, which is to describe an unforgettable encounter you've had with an artist or their work at some time in your life. And then those fragments were woven together so that you can't quite tell who said what experience or what idea. It's a small project, but I just wanted to show it to you quickly. One of the other things about working as an artist is you're always torturing things. You're always cutting and burning. And this is glass that's set into a kiln on a hand-carved mold that looks like this. And then the kiln fires it at 1,500 degrees, and the glass becomes almost molten so that it takes the shape of the mold. And then you create it in panels, and it creates an image like this. This is a project called The Dreaming, and it's a layered work in sculptural glass and weaving, but the weaving is a painted illusion. I do some painting. And so this is a large-scale, architectural-scale weaving made from a very small, like a notebook-size, paper-size weaving that I work with a weaver on. This is her, Margaret Haluk, terrific, nationally known weaver. And that painted illusion of a weaving is installed on a very historic building, and then the glass is suspended over the weaving in a kind of a veil like this, filled with artifacts from the cultural history of this city, a handful of artifacts, or maybe two handfuls, all of which represent these extraordinary dreams individuals had that ended up changing the cultural landscape of the area and the region and eventually the nation. For example, this spiral is a drawing by Frank Lloyd Wright for a building near this town in Frederick County that never got built. It failed. The whole vision failed, but it became the ancestor for one of the great buildings of the 20th century, the Guggenheim Museum in New York, with its spiral process. And the big word say, S-A-Y here, from Francis Scott Key's handwriting, the draft of the Star-Spangled Banner. And so this project was designed to explore the whole notion of dreaming, of how these very modest, fleeting ideas that you have, these wishes, are not these idle daydreams or fantasies. If you follow them, they actually become the very food of human progress itself. These whimsical thoughts you have, what if I did this? What if I created images on the walls of towns? What if I did a building as a spiral? What if I... These dreams that are just very subtle thoughts at first, and you entertain them, and they take root, they become seeds, and they change worlds over time. Thank you. That there's text that's etched on the back of the glass. It actually starts at ground. These are all the artifacts, the different artifacts that appear in this image. There's text that we gathered throughout the community in 120 conversations where people were brought together and asked a series of very personal questions. Questions like, what were the dreams of your parents? Which most people have never really thought about. They don't even think about their parents as having dreams. And usually most people, all they can say is, well, I am the dream of my parents, because that's all they can experience. But there were dreams there that we're not necessarily aware of. By the way, this word liberty is a quote from Thomas Jefferson in the handwriting of a diarist during the Civil War who was celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation and quoting Jefferson in his diary back in the Civil War. And it turns out Jefferson actually stayed on this site, which has been the site of a tavern or a hotel, all the way back to the American Revolution. He stayed here on his way to Philadelphia to write the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson, of course, is so well known here, but in Frederick, that was the only time he was ever there. And he had his portable violin with him, his little violin he made for travel. So the text that was gathered from all the different people is etched right into the stone of the building, and it rises up and it jumps to the glass and it goes straight up five stories and kind of disappears into that radiance of light that the glass reflects. And these are questions. The last question we ask people is, if anything were possible, what would you create? And that's the answer to those texts were gathered by trained witnesses, and they were woven together into this work. These conversations were held in coffee shops and schools. This is the police department, the executives of the police department, young mothers at risk, construction companies, schools all over the community, so that the work would be embedded with the dreams of everyday people. We were trying to explore whether this act of dreaming is universal or not. And then at the base of the work will be this kind of an outdoor museum that tells the stories of all these artifacts and the history and so on. But this work isn't necessarily the focus of this evening. I just wanted to give you a sense of how we work sometimes. This is another smaller project on a city wall in New York. And there are six figures here that are painted illusions and one figure that's real. The woman with the umbrella is a passerby, and the children are painted illusions. And sometimes people will stop and ask these kids for directions because they think that they're real. And this is a style of painting. You're probably familiar with it. It's called trompe l'oeil. It means fool the eye, a French term meaning fool the eye. It's a style of painting that is realistic enough that it tries to create the illusion of a three-dimensional reality on a two-dimensional surface. Here's another example. Everything, including the window frame, is a painted illusion. The brick is real. These are set into the bricked-up windows of a neo-Gothic building in Martinsburg, West Virginia. And I believe with public art, the closer you get, the more there should be to see and to discover. And it was in learning to try to paint this way, which is incredibly difficult to do. It would almost be easier to break through this wall with your head than to create an image that looks this real. It's that difficult. It's extremely difficult to do, especially when you have to do it on deadline. And what makes it difficult is because we are convinced that what we see is real. And you don't realize that everything that you see is an illusion until you try to recreate it verbatim in paint or any other medium for that matter. And when you try to do that, the painting looks not very good. And you conclude that I have no talent. The painting looks good, looks bad, because I don't have any talent. But that's the myth. The reality is that the painting doesn't look all that great because you painted what you thought you saw instead of what's really there. And we do not like hearing this. We don't like hearing that everything we see is an illusion. Unfortunately, it happens to be the truth. It's also very liberating, as we'll see in a moment. But if you look at this diagram, this illustration was done by a professor of vision at MIT, and it's called the checker square illusion. And if you look at square A and square B, there are two squares that are marked with letters. Which one is darker? Which square, A or B? Which one is darker? A is darker. Everybody agree with that? No? Why do you not agree? Yeah. Well, the truth is that for almost everyone, A looks not just a little darker, but significantly darker. They are identical. Neither is darker than the other. And you can prove it by putting the same value of gray next to them, and you can see they're absolutely identical. I see a lot of open mouths here. And so if I take those away again, A looks darker, right? And if you could see this clearly, you would see them as the same, but we cannot. We're hardwired. Our brain interferes with the information our eye gives to our brains. And we think we see something that's not there. And this relational seeing, we see things in relation and we jump to conclusions, not jump to conclusions, our brain gives us conclusions that aren't true. It's very helpful in evolution and survival when you're trying to see a tiger in the shadows of the jungle. You know, that increase or that illusion of contrast helps you to survive. But if you're really trying to see what's right in front of you, it distorts everything that you see. And the thing is, I've spent 20 years trying to learn to see more clearly, and to me, A still looks darker. I have to test it myself to see. There's no way that you can train yourself not to see this at first. Another example of trompe l'oeil is if you look at a color, if you look at an image of a person, one of the first things you see is the color, and you think painting is all about color. If you look at that same image and see only the color and not the value, the relative lights and darks, you can barely recognize it as a person, as this image shows. But if you look at that image and take away the color and leave only the value, the relative lights and darks, you could still recognize this person, you could converse with her. And so what's most important in painting is darks and lights, not color. That's the hardest thing to get across to painting students. But you can learn to see accurately enough to create the illusion of 3D reality. Even a young student like this who had done very little trompe l'oeil painting in just 3 days created the illusion of this head of Caesar because it's something that's learnable. It's not so much about talent. It's all about the passion to learn. If you can imagine just how different A and B looked, I'm going to show you another example where there is a very slight difference, but we inflate it to enormous proportion, just like we inflate the difference between A and B. There are five people here. Well, it's upside down. Let's look at it right side up. Five people here, and there's a very slight difference between one and all the others, almost imperceptible. Let me bring it into focus here. One of these people is considered very different from all the others, so different it's the first time in history that that person was elected president of the United States. But you can see, if you look at, you know, the first black president. Well, there's nothing here black. This is black. In fact, that's not even black. This is black. Or this is black. You know, we have such an enormous load of baggage, and it's all political, on differences that don't, that have no basis in biological reality. Right? Albert Einstein said, reality is merely an illusion, albeit a persistent one. I'm going to tell you the story of Community Bridge. This is actually an older project. But it's very interesting because in this project, we started doing what we call participatory art, which is where you invite the public to engage in the creation of public art so that they shape the meaning and design of the work, rather than you creating a work and telling the audience what it means or letting the audience live with it. This is the project that this is about, Community Bridge. I won't say anything at this point. I'll just show you a little bit about how it developed. Frederick, Maryland had a creek running through it that would flood and wipe out huge swaths of the downtown. Very, very destructive. You can't restore historic buildings in a floodplain. Frederick was founded in 1745, and so it was very important to preserve these buildings. They decided to put a underground flood control project through the downtown instead of a ditch, which would have cost one-tenth as much, because the town was historically divided by race, and they didn't want to put a ditch through that would further divide the city. The south side has been majority black since time immemorial, the north side majority white. The idea was to build a linear park that would unite the town and be the city's most important economic development project. As the conduits were being built, the $60 million flood control project, they were trying to convince the community about what the park should be and what it should look like. And they ran into tremendous controversy. People were fighting and bickering over how it should be designed, what it should include. And so for about 15 years, these conduits sat blank while this controversy went on. And the city and the volunteers who were trying to make the park happen were getting mauled in the public day after day in the press. They decided to make this bridge the first finished structure in the park. They were going to clad it with cast stone, a type of pigmented cement. And at that point, we interceded and said that bridge should be an artwork because right now the park is going nowhere. The developers have all gotten scared off. A lot of them lost their shirts and the rest have fled. And there's no development possible happening. And the city's going to go down having committed to a project of this scope unless you can find a way to get people to pull together. We decided that, you know, the bridge could be painted to look like an old stone bridge. This idea was more controversial than anything that had come before. There were a lot of letters to the editor, radio shows, you know. There was a national radio show about the guy that wanted to paint a bridge on a bridge and things like that. There was a poll done in the paper, and this was during a terrible recession in the early 90s. In lieu of today's economic times, do you think it is right for the city of Frederick to pay $70,000 to have a mural done on the Carroll Street Bridge? Yes, 16. No, 109. No opinion, 31. This was a phone-in poll. 31 people called up and said, you know, I have no opinion about that. But, well, it's good for people to be involved, right? And the city commissioned the project after investigating it thoroughly because they were pretty desperate. Nothing had worked. It was getting worse and worse. And so why not turn it over to a crazy artist? At least they could distance themselves from such an undertaking if it failed. And so the first thing we did was put a temporary artwork on the bridge, letters that looked like they were carved, but they were a trompe-l'oeil painted illusion that said this is a shared vision. And it was both about this artwork, but also about the whole park. Either we pull together or we're going down. And Teresa and I founded a nonprofit called Shared Vision, Public Art for Community Imagination, whose mission was to harness, what did I say? Okay. I like that better. Why don't we change the name? Okay. public art for community transformation, designed with a mission to harness the imaginative power of the community itself as a catalyst for social, cultural, and economic transformation. Participatory art. Art in an area where there were social issues, cultural issues, and deep economic problems. And as the project was being prepared for painting, and there was a lot of work involved with that, we were trying to figure out how to engage the community in the project. We had all kinds of esoteric ideas, but eventually we settled on a very simple question to ask the whole community. And the question was, what object represents the spirit of community to you? If you want to figure out what is a community or what's it about or where does it go or what does it mean, sometimes you have to ask the community itself. And it's not enough to ask just a few people. You have to ask every single segment, every population segment, every geographical area. So Teresa led an effort that took a year where community leaders designed an outreach powerful enough to reach into every sector and every corner of the community. Volunteers distributed posters community-wide to ask this question. You could fill out a response card, tear it off, and send it back with your idea. And at first, people didn't know what we were talking about. You know, this idea, this question was everywhere. It was on the radio, it was on television, posters, media, direct mail, on this sign on 270 to reach commuters for 6 days, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 6 weeks. And we tracked it to make sure we were hitting every population segment and geographical area. And as the project went forward, we were collecting these ideas one and two at a time at first because people didn't know what to make of it. But then we started getting more ideas. And we were laying out the stonework, the painted illusion of stonework on the bridge and painting it in. And this kid had ditched school that day and was out and about, and he came across the painting. It was a high crime area. One arts volunteer had gotten stabbed at the beginning of the project. Our scaffolding was being thrown in the creek. We'd have to fish it out in the morning to go painting. And these are some of the ideas we got back. This was part of an art exhibit at a visual arts center next to the bridge. You can see that there's a great diversity of ideas here, and there are also some commonalities. We had no idea what would happen with this effort, whether anything intelligent would come out of it, whether it would be even worth doing, but we began adding these symbols to the bridge as these painted stone carvings. Carvings that look, this is all just a painted illusion on the face of the bridge. And the common denominators we began to discern in the community ideas began to shape the major features of the bridge. They were inspired by common thoughts found in many different people's ideas. There are four of those major features. And the single ideas we heard repeated over and over again became the inspiration for the four medallions of the bridge. So there's a certain rhyme or reason to how the thing is organized, as we shall see. For example, one person said a fiddle represents community because it connects the whole bluegrass community. But from another perspective, that's a violin, and it connects another entire community. A lawyer said the way two fish school together represent community. An artist said a never-ending knot that doubles back on itself and is continuous. Someone said a parking meter represents community because it's a device that encourages the sharing of a scarce resource. I would never have thought of that. Somebody said people intertwine. In fact, I think it was about 40 different people said people intertwined, or people in a knot, a Celtic knot, or people interconnected. And this is from the Book of Kells. A gyroscope for the internal balance. Many, many symbols were suggested. All of these I'm showing you now turned out to have a common denominator of circles interconnected. A single mother said, a spider web represents community. The individual strands are delicate and fragile, but together they're strong and flexible. The hands of a couple clasped in childbirth. Circles interconnected, two hands circling around each other. A figure eight knot is a mountain climbing knot. You lash it to your buddy and he becomes your lifeline. Oops, repeat. A man dying of cancer suggested a sun and a moon symbol combined. And he said he was in Key West and he saw the sun come up while the moon was still up, so the light never went away. He said his symbol for the bridge was a sun and a moon because he stopped being afraid of death when he realized the light would never go away for him. The light was fellow cancer patients. He said, they'll come whenever you need them. They'll come in the middle of the night if necessary. This is the sign language symbol for unity, which is based on two links of a chain. The Maryland School for the Deaf is on the hill just above Community Bridge. All of those have one common denominator, which is circles interconnected, circles interlinked. They became the inspiration for the Unfound Door, which is a gate of interconnected circles of different sizes It's a gate, not a door. The title, The Unfound Door, refers to the plain wooden door that's visible behind the gate. And it's a symbol that represents these interconnections that support our lives. We take them for granted. They're invisible to us. But if you think about it, you cannot wake up in the morning, sit up, put your feet on the floor without collaborating with 50 other people. The person that built your bed, the person that sewed your night clothes, the person that, you know, installed the floor, and on and on and on. We're embedded in this network of interconnections on all sides that supports our existence. Albert Einstein said, a human being is part of the whole, called by us universe. We experience ourselves, our thoughts and feelings as something apart from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of our consciousness. The delusion is a kind of prison for us. Our task must be to free ourselves from the prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures. So the interconnections and the interdependence that people talked about in their ideas with circles interconnected are represented in this symbol. There's an angel head on each side of the gate, one African-American, one Caucasian that based on neighborhood children, one from the south side of the creek, one from the north side. And if you look close, that's the quote white child, and this is the quote black child. They're the same stuff. They're the same stone. There's a black and a white butterfly here, almost to remind you like there's about as much difference between a black and a white child as there is between a black and a white butterfly. You know, it depends on how you see it. It depends on your perspective. We see differences that aren't there. We do it all the time. An entomologist was taking a bridge tour, and he heard this butterfly metaphor, and he said, that's not true. He said, there's more difference between that black and white butterfly than between any two human beings on Earth during all of history. So that comment now is part of the tour. There's the neighborhood child that one was based on. And you can see that they're the same stuff. We see differences that simply aren't there. And there's a medallion, about 50, no, how many people said? There's all the people that said black and white hands clasped. Okay. So the media was carrying this further, and people were sending ideas from outside of Frederick. One person said rhythm, one person said breastfeeding, one person said the first footprint, the man on the moon. It was a shared experience that all humanity had. E pluribus unum, out of many, one, the U.S. motto. Someone said a puzzle piece, a child, in fact, snowflakes. A child said no matter how different two people are, the more their ideas and values will blend into one when they're together, if they're together often enough. You can see how the ideas are woven into the stonework of the bridge. And a teacher said the drinking gourd represents community to her. The drinking gourd was the African name for the Big Dipper, and it was also the name of a song, Follow the Drinking Gourd, that was taught to undercover members, taught by undercover members of the Underground Railroad to slaves in the South during the Civil War. They traveled the South and taught this song to slaves who sang it in the fields while they worked. And the song contained coded instructions to follow the Underground Railroad north and to freedom. The teacher suggested the symbol because she said she hoped, she said that the collective courage and determination of those who operated the Underground Railroad to ensure the same rights and freedoms for everyone represented community to her. That's why she wanted it in the bridge. Became the inspiration for this major feature based on this notion of our differences are superficial and our commonalities are core. And this is a sculpture by a world-famous sculptor named William Henry Reinhart. This is just a painted illusion, but he was did most of his work in Italy, and he was actually born in Frederick County, right near the bridge. And it was his first life-size piece. It was his only biblical theme, and he said it was about, he called it the Woman of Samaria, about a man who met a woman at a well, and she was an enemy to him by race and by religion. And she was inferior by her gender. She was of questionable moral background. They never should have been speaking, but they had a conversation at this well many, many years ago. And this great Jewish teacher, who today is revered by Muslims and Christians alike, spoke to her like anyone else, recognized her essential humanity. And so it represents this notion in the bridge, our differences are superficial, our commonalities are core. We're showing at it at an angle here so you can see it's just a flat painting. The medallion that goes with that was suggested by many, many children. It's called the Children's Medallion, the Earth Held in Hands, surrounded by people holding hands. There's a lot of ivy on the bridge. This ivy gets a lot of complaints, though. People call the city every so often, and they say, you know, you've got a beautiful painted bridge, but you're letting ivy grow on it. It's going to ruin the painting. You've got to pull that off of there. Pam Jaffe did a lot of the ivy painting during the project. Another common denominator, things that are living, things that are alive. A student said that a chameleon can change to suit its needs. A community should be able to do the same. Interesting comment, considering all of the resistance to change and integration and development that was being experienced down here. Wheat farms arose for how the petals circle around a common core. A very old resident said, sunfish, we used to catch them in this creek as a child. Agriculture tractor, a physician said DNA, the basic building block of life. There's an acorn sprouting. An engineer who was constructing the underground conduits dug up this old milk bottle and brought it and said, here, put this in the bridge. We all used to get these on our doorstep in the morning. The way dolphins school, they became the inspiration for this major feature, which is called the Forgotten Song. And this is a circle of life. It's also the kind of fountain that was once found in markets and squares in the days before indoor plumbing. And news was exchanged here. People came to get water and gossip, and they became like centers of community in their own right. But it represents our connection to a larger community, the biosphere, that supports our existence every day. We can't live apart from it. And the fruits of our labor and our imagination are meaningless without the fruits of the earth that support our existence. We're connected to the earth, and we cannot not be connected and survive. Every idea, every object was someone's idea for community. Somebody said ginkgo leaves for the ancient roots of community, honeysuckle, a lily for forgiveness, and on, more than I have time to go into. About 125 ideas gathered together here. Somebody said water, somebody said a fountain, doves, grapes, grapevines, they're all combined together here, representing this larger community that we live in. The medallion that goes with it is a tree. About 50 different people said a tree represents community. It's deeply rooted. One person said all the parts of the tree conspire to create the ultimate goal, which is the fruit. We had a lot of events, and people were getting more and more involved. The media was carrying the message out there. We started getting ideas from all over the country for this project. And as we got, you know, we were getting ideas by the thousands, more than we could really keep up with. And people were coming down to see what's going on. This is a group of artists from Europe who came to see the project. These are all countries where people sent us their ideas for the bridge because they heard about this and they wanted to contribute to it. So the meaning of the bridge grew stronger. A soldier in Bosnia sent her idea. She heard about the project from her tent mate who read about it in a Florida newspaper. Her symbol was a symbol for the International Peacekeeping Force in Bosnia that stopped the slaughter there. She said it shows what can happen when we all work together. Somebody from Chile said, not all that you see is exactly what you see. What if the air was solid and the stone were hollow? Reality doesn't always have to be what we've been taught to believe. And this introduces the last common denominator, which I won't express for a moment. See if you, it took me a while to see it. All these did. This is an impossible triangle. It was sent by somebody in Israel. This is a circle suggested by a group of women with Alzheimer's in a facility for people with Alzheimer's. They said, at the beginning of our life, we were part of a circle of friends, and now at the end of our life, we've come full circle and we're part of another circle. And by the way, the circle is the master symbol for the bridge. It's the one thing that's in almost all the ideas. There is a circle central to almost every idea everyone sent. Someone said this, the tracks of subatomic particles represent community, the way they circle around each other. Someone else said the solar system and the way it circles. Netherlands, a Christmas wreath. A shofar in the Jewish tradition, a ceremonial ram's horn used to call people together. 1864, the cornerstone for the first black church in Frederick. A person meditating, a legendary civil rights leader, when I asked him this question, he led voter registration drives in the South. And most people who did that didn't survive. This was in the 60s. So I thought he'd say something about civil rights. And he said, a person meditating is my symbol for community. I said, why? And he said, because a person meditating or a person praying is contacting a level of reality beneath the surface differences like gender and language and age and all the things. This is the children's hand play sequence. Here's the church. Here's the steeple. Open the doors. See all the people. Falling star, suggested by a real estate agent, said we all have the same experience when we see a falling star, excitement, inspiration, feeling of a divine power that might shape our world. The clustered spires of Frederick in the medallion, suggested by all of these people, for religious pluralism. By this time, the bridge was looking like this, but we still hadn't got the final thing that would sum it all up, you know, the common denominator. There was a Buddhist begging bowl. There was a Native American prayer wheel. Finally, it dawned on me that there was this common theme of connection to a higher community, whatever you might perceive that to be, the all-seeing eye, open church door from the black church on the other side of the creek, Buddhist begging bowl. And so this last feature is called Archangel, and it sums up kind of what we heard, what we learned, what the project meant with all of these ideas. And this is what you come to after seeing all these very normal, very tame-looking things, an image that looks distorted, like there's something wrong with it, like it's stretched. And the longer you look at it, you know, the worse it seems to look. I mean, what's wrong with this? And I imagine people look at it and go, modern art, you know, what is that? But it looks distorted, but there's no distortion here at all, none. And it looks distorted because we're coming at it with a preconception in our minds that makes it look distorted to us. And that preconception is invisible to us. We can't see it operating. And that preconception is that you're looking at it from the correct angle. And if you walk around and try to puzzle out what's going on with this image, you find the correct angle, and the image is completely transformed. The distortion goes away like it was never there to begin with, because it was never there. And it shows that where you stand determines what you see. You know, the community looks incredibly divided, and it looks distorted, and it looks wrong. You know, there's so many things wrong about the world. But then you see this bridge, and how easily pain can fool the eye becomes a metaphor. You know, you really, the human condition is to feel alone, isolated, cut off. It was a Thoreau that said, most people lead lives of quiet desperation. You see the bridge and you hear all these stories, it's a little bit like climbing a mountain. It gives you this new perspective on the human condition. You realize everyone values connection as much as you do. And so the bridge becomes the symbol for connection and common ground. Bridges take separate land and they make common ground. And we always have the choice to see past those differences that lock us into stereotypes of who we can connect with. And so we cut ourselves off from others without even knowing we're doing it, because of the perspective we've taken that we're not aware of is a stance, and there are other options. So we always have a choice to find those other perspectives, those other options. We always have a choice to build a bridge, to walk across a bridge. This project has a lot in it about connections. You know, we feel cut off, but we're connected to the earth, according to the community with the forgotten song that supports our existence. We're connected below. And the unfound door shows we're connected on all sides with other people. We're interconnected permanently, really. And this shows we're connected to a value within that a master can see, even if we can't most of the time. And Archangel shows we're connected to some higher community, however you interpret that. We're connected below, on all sides, within, we're connected above. We're connected in every possible direction, always. The bridge project was drawing so many people by the time it was done to this high crime area. We had to give tours all day, every day, for the last 3 years of this five-year project. School groups, corporate groups were coming down. Locals were asked to tell their stories about, you know, symbols to a larger audience. There's a sign that explains some of these things. We have every stone in the bridge sponsored by an individual or a company, and all of these companies were the big donors and individuals. Philanthropy really built this project. There were $300,000 in-kind contributions, volunteer labor and equipment and so on. We celebrated the final event at the end of the project in 98 with a multimedia event that was broadcast on the web. One of the early examples of internet broadcasting, live music and dance. There was a video message from a sister project in South Africa that was sent over. They were transforming a bridge connecting Johannesburg and Soweto that were divided on under apartheid. And they spoke to the whole Frederick crowd from South Africa on common ground. Fascinating, very emotional. And then a Native American composer gave the final blessing. And we were trying to make as much noise as possible down there to change the perception of the future of this creek project as a way to bring jobs downtown for the people that really needed them, especially in some of the depressed areas down there. And so about 50,000 people a year were coming down by the end of the project. and it was being written about a lot, and developers began to get interested in all this bare concrete and parking lots, and they redesigned the plan for the creek. This time it went forward without controversy. They invited the whole community to come down and paint that mile of conduits with their own paintings, and then they built the park on top of those paintings, kind of as the foundation for the park. Developers snapped up all the property, and this is what it looks like today. I'm told that $300 million in public and private development has been invested now there. 1,500 jobs are brought downtown where they're badly needed. All the bridges are art bridges. There are, you know, everything from Section 8 housing to million-dollar condos side by side along the creek. Fountains, amenities, first floor retail. So you now have what it took us, the opportunity to do what it took us 5 years to learn, which is to see through these differences. It took me a long time to understand what the collective voice was saying through the project. And it's been a real pleasure to be here and talk to you today. If you have any questions, I'd love to answer them. And then I know we need to move on to the next part of the program this evening. Anybody have any questions? Yes, sir.
What kind of upkeep is there on a mural such as that? Is there constant work that has to be done to
No. Surprisingly not. I mean, we use very, very permanent paint from Germany that chemically bonds with the masonry surface. It'll never peel. It'll never fade. It takes almost no upkeep except occasional repair because of some imperfections in the surface. I mean, once every 4 years possibly at the most, you might spend a few hours down there. Everybody wants to know about vandalism. At the beginning of the project, there was a lot of vandalism on this bridge, never on the painted portions, always on the unpainted portions. And it stayed almost completely vandalism-free for about a decade. It's about 15 years old now. And then there was one, you know, pretty significant incident. But questions about vandalism, I think, misunderstand the direction of the threat. Most of the damage that's ever done to our public art projects happens by other kinds of vandalism. People in ties and people wearing pearls. You know, there's a lot of politics in public art projects, more than you could possibly imagine. And we've lost whole projects to politics, whereas the ones that were completed have been out there for years without getting vandalized. So the risks are coming from directions that you might not expect, if that makes sense. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for coming. This is extremely interesting. I guess you speak of all the people's images of community. What is your image of community?
It's a bridge. My symbol is a bridge. Bridges take separate land and they make common ground. And that's, I didn't realize that until almost at the end. I was trying to explain what this thing meant. There is one other symbol in there that I contributed, and that was the hands of a couple clasped in childbirth, which I put in when Teresa was pregnant with our son, with our first son. Yeah. Yes, sir. Thank you.
To me, the work that you showed us really shows some sort of like deeper meaning. There's a lot behind it, and it seems that you set out to sort of tap into something in the community that you were putting this art into. And you said that you weren't an artist originally, you were in college or something. So when you started making art, did you have these ideas and set out to do these types of things, or was it more or less that you decided, found out that you had a talent in art, and saw it as a good way to project these ideas in the community?
I never thought I had a talent in art. And I was always interested in theater, philosophy, English, literature, poetry. My favorite author is Vladimir Nabokov, who is a got some fans, Pale Fire and Lolita. And it wasn't until I realized what I wanted to do that I realized that was something called art. And if I wanted to do that, I might actually turn out to be an artist, which would seem to me to be a ridiculous fate. And I remember an artist friend, when I was trying to talk him into doing it with me because I was too scared to try it alone, he goes, you know, if we're going to do what you're talking about, we're going to have to learn how to paint. And I said, yeah, we'll burn that bridge when we come to it. You know, we got to get this done. I don't care. You know, I just dove in, and it was excruciating to do it that way. But I think it's excruciating to do it any other way as well. Art is very hard, very hard to do it well. And Michelangelo, I mean, you look at the quotes about how terribly difficult it is, and yet anything that you're passionate about, you will climb mountains, you know, all the love poetry. You get passionate about something and nothing will stop you. And what you end up doing is creating yourself out of that experience. So there's an artwork left behind, but you come away with more of yourself than you thought was there, because we are all these like acorns. Even the most accomplished of us have just barely begun to scratch the surface of the potential within us. And you think you have no talent, it's just another excuse, you know. You just haven't, you know, you have to find that thing that you're so passionate about that you will move heaven and earth to pull it out of you from somewhere you didn't even know it was there, and it manifests right in front of your nose, and you're more surprised than anybody. You've killed yourself to get there. It's extremely difficult. And then someone will come up and say, what are you doing? Are you an artist? Oh, I wish I had your talent. No, you don't, or you would be doing it, because if you want, that's what it takes to do it, is that desire more than the talent. It's a very rambling answer. I don't know if that answered the question or not. But it was. It's always, to me, it's always about seeing something in my mind's eye that I want to create so badly that I'll be willing to go through anything to do it. And then going through all of that, trying to make it a survivable event. And in the end, only capturing 5% of what I saw in my mind's eye, but that's a lot better than nothing. And being happy with that and thinking I failed, but at least I had the experience. And then looking back on it a couple years later and going, you know, that's not too bad. The vision is much more powerful than the creation, at least in my experience. Yes, sir. Yes. There's an urban art trail in Rochester that will involve the community even on a larger scale than this, we hope, and it involves a whole group of cultural institutions and creating an outdoor museum that connects them. There's a large mural up in Hershey, Pennsylvania, part of a new museum there, and some glass sculptures in Baltimore and Washington parks. Teresa and I together are doing aesthetic design for an express diagnostic center in a hospital in Montgomery County, Maryland. These are all really interesting, unusual ways of incorporating art, but the opportunities that come are never the ones you think you're going to want to do, and you get into it and you really get hooked on it, and it's like the world works against art. You know, the whole purpose of the world is not set up for art to flourish. You're always working at cross purposes, so it's almost as if the world is all about, you know, profit-taking and all these different things. And it's just this very narrow crawl space for creativity to be encouraged and to happen. And so you're always trying to insert this huge vision into these little opportunities and then trying to expand them almost like kudzu to create something that shifts the reality rather than being shifted by the reality, if that makes sense. That's kind of what this was about, in a sense. You know, I not to use an overused word recently, but hope is a really, really important word. And I think that we are bombarded with negativity every day. And I mean hammered. We're, you know, carpet bombed. Especially if you connect up with the media and just hear what's going on out there. And you know, you can really lose your hope pretty quick. But there is also this other part of us that is in most of us, to a large measure, sleeping, that can be awoken. And it's like awakening a giant. And it's there in every single person I've ever met, despite how it feels. How many people agree with, was it Thoreau who said, most people lead lives of quiet desperation? How many people agree with that? I usually notice that there's like 3/4 of the audience puts their hands up. That is the human condition. And what makes, I remember we were trying to do this project, it was a very difficult project to pull off financially, very underfunded. And I said to the chairman of Shared Vision, who is, you know, who we became good friends with since, how are we going to find this money to do this? It's hundreds of thousands of dollars we have to raise, and it's already controversial. And he said, you know, money is pretty common. What's rare is vision. And we've got that. And I didn't believe it at first, but when you put something in front of people that they can believe in, all and that they have a role to play, a contribution to make. All people need is the slightest push sometimes, and you can harness the collective power of people's hope and vision and imagination and move mountains. But you have to kind of, it has to be authentic, has to be for real, you have to be doing it for the right reasons, because they feel it on a level they can't even describe, and then they start contributing to it, and it starts to pick up momentum, almost imperceptibly at first, and you gotta believe. You have to be, you know, you have to want it so badly that when you get crushed, even for the fourth time, you get up and go, is that all you got? You know, I mean, you gotta, you know, it's almost a form of like madness in a way, that you will absolutely not take no for an answer if you believe in it, if you feel like you're on the right path. And there's this, it's like the process of entrainment, because people, this part of them resonates with that, and they start to, they fall in beside you, you know, and then the next person. And it doesn't matter if it's a big effort or a small effort, but you know what I'm talking about, right? And there is nothing we're facing right now that we can't solve. I've never seen conditions worse, by the way, with global warming and wars and the economy. But we, no matter how bad it gets, we cannot be subdivided for real, only in our heads. So we can't let it take hold. It's just not true. We're not divided. You're not different than me in any real way. Yes, we have our differences make us stronger. And so you find that real core. And then you build on it, and it's just a seed, like in the dreaming, it's just a seed, but you build on it and build on it and build on it, and don't give up. Absolutely real. The rest of it is not real. Okay, yes, sir. Well, I'm sorry, what was the second question? What motivates? I think a fundamental clinical insanity is probably... if you think about what Picasso said, I'm always doing that which I can't do in order to be able to do it. We think that first you get all the training and you have the talent, you get the whole package, and then you do the thing. And I don't think it works that way for most of us. I think you find what it is you want more than anything else, and then you... I spent a lot of time studying philosophy, so when somebody asked me that question about what would you do if anything were possible and you were guaranteed to be successful, I had already come to the belief that we have much more within us than we realize. And you look at Archangel, and it looks distorted, and it's downright irritating because it just is right in your face how distorted it is, and yet none of that is real. Or those two values that look different, but they were the same. We think that we're hollow men. We think that we're lacking. We think that we're flawed. We think that there's something wrong with us, and on and on and on. And all of that is an illusion. It's just not real. But you don't find that out until you say, well, screw it, I'm going to do it anyway because I want to do it badly enough. That's how acorns become oaks. That's how these little dreams turn into these, you know, history-changing visions that no one would have ever bet a dollar on. It's in there. It's inside. And if you don't believe it, you can go your whole life and miss it. But life isn't a process of scratching out survival existence on a ball of dirt floating in space. There's a lot more going on here. One of the things about learning to see with trompe l'oeil is you begin to realize that we're living every day in the equivalent of an old master painting. You all are that beautiful. You know, if Rembrandt saw you, he would give his eye teeth to paint you. Every single person here. We don't pay attention to that. We miss that, but it's absolutely true. And I have to turn it off because it's too intense. You know how a child's perception is almost overwhelming? It's like that. And that's just a metaphor for the multidimensional nature of the self that we don't even realize is there. There's no problem that's a match for that if it can be harnessed, if it can be discovered, and it's discovered through passion and desire and vision and then pursuing that at all costs, not taking no for an answer. And you create the self you want to be by following what you want to create, what you wish, what you think you would create if you already had that self. You have to call it into being. You don't get it and then get to do it armed for it. You call it into being. Thanks, Albert. This idea of being interconnected and interdependent, we will no longer survive if we keep thinking the way we have been thinking, because we're burning out the planet and there are too many of us. We have to do it, come at it a whole different way. And we're going to be facing massive change in the coming couple of decades, faster pace than we've ever thought could even happen. And we have to hold on to what's real. We have to see it. We have to see through the illusion if we're going to make it. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.